Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya on the lands of Gunnamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
And the use of, you know, online platforms continues to be of concern. So lawmakers need to be keeping an eye on where are the cracks that offenders are, exploiting, and where does, you know, how do we continue to make our legislation relevant?
Under a new scheme in New South Wales, police have the power to track phones of domestic violence offenders. The scheme also requires those with a serious history of abuse to disclose it on dating profiles. But how is Australia catching up with technology? Also, costs from extreme weather continue to skyrocket, with recent analysis estimating losses of $4.5 billion a year, according to Insurance Council of Australia reporting. And later...
AI-generated models do not have any of the normal flaws or imperfections that an everyday person might have.
A flawless, blue-eyed blonde model on the cover of Vogue is turning heads, but she's AI-generated. Images like these are raising concern, with some worried they could threaten efforts in diversity. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, over 1,500 families and young people with disability have responded to a nationwide survey, which revealed 80% of participants believe the government's Thriving Kids rollout window leaves little time to prepare, risking vital supports. The survey by Children and Young People with Disability Australia was launched following NDIS Minister Mark Butler's announcement of the program back in August. Thriving Kids is an alternative set of supports aimed at some children with developmental delay and autism who are under the age of 9. But the program is set to launch in July 2026, giving governments and providers just 9 months to prepare. Powered Media's reporter Emma Myers spoke with CIDA CEO Sky Kokoschke-Moore about the survey results.
In late August and early September, Children and Young People with Disability Australia ran a public survey shortly after Minister Butler announced Thriving Kids. We wanted to really get a sense from the community about what they thought of the announcement and what they hoped Thriving Kids would deliver. We heard from more than 1,500 families and young people who responded to a series of questions. So we asked, what sorts of supports would you like to see out of Thriving Kids? And overwhelmingly, allied health supports are really in demand. So when I talk about allied health, I mean things like occupational therapy, speech therapy, physiotherapy, and psychology. And parents also told us that they are very interested in parenting programs as well.
What were some of the concerns outlined in the survey?
Sadly, we heard that the vast majority of respondents felt really worried about the timeline. Some were fearful. 51% were confused. So I think that's not surprising given the announcement came quite out of the blue and with not a lot of information wrapped around it. So we also need to keep in mind that this announcement comes on top of a couple of years of consultation regarding foundational supports. And again, families and young people still not being sure what foundational supports are. So we're having uncertainty laid on top of more uncertainty. Other things that families and young people told us was that they felt nervous about the idea of schools being responsible for delivering Thriving Kids. That's due to a couple of reasons. One, an understanding and an acknowledgement that teachers are already stretched and schools are already stretched, and this would be another responsibility for them to fit into their day. What we did hear, though, is that families and young people are really concerned about a lack of choice and control and individualized supports where Thriving Kids programs are delivered in a block-funded model. A lot of respondents said that they were worried that Having block-funded services would mean children would be forced into a one-size-fits-all program when we know that one-size-fits-all never works. And so, no matter what is delivered through Thriving Kids, it's really important that those individual needs can be met and that any services, if they are block-funded, can be shown to have a strong evidence base and that children and young people will be able to benefit from the supports that are being provided rather than any harm being done.
We heard from the Thriving Kids Inquiry on Friday. What did that reveal?
I believe it was one of the first public hearings for the parliamentary inquiry. There are some more public hearings coming up later this month. I understand that a few disability organisations presented on the day and that what they were really concerned about was the timeline for rollout and also similar sentiments around wanting to make sure that whatever Thriving Kids looks like, it meets the genuine needs of children, particularly when the government has signaled that they are going to move to change the eligibility criteria for the NDIS starting in the middle of 2027.
What are your hopes for this survey? How do you think these findings will shape the future of Thriving Kids?
SADA is really fortunate because we are on the Thriving Kids Advisory Group. We launched this survey long before we knew that we were going to be invited. So, what we really wanted to do was make sure that whoever was making decisions about Thriving Kids had those decisions informed by the views of the community that will be the ones accessing those supports. So, we hope that by sharing with the government and with the advisory group that families are really worried about the timeframe for the rollout, that the government will consider how they can meaningfully roll out a program in such a short space of time in a way that won't do any harm and in a way that children won't be worse off. And we also hope that the survey will demonstrate for the government the sorts of supports that families of children under 9 really need. And so our survey has told us that things like psychology, occupational therapy, speech therapy, physiotherapy, and parenting programs are right at the top of the list of the supports that really make a difference. The Federal Parliament has set up an inquiry into Thriving Kids. I'd really encourage anybody who is listening, who has an interest in shaping what Thriving Kids looks like, to make a submission to that inquiry. That committee is going to produce a report which will be presented to the Parliament, and the Thriving Kids Advisory Group will also be reviewing it. So, all the input that we can get from the community means that Thriving Kids will end up being a better product at the end of the day.
Children and Young People with Disability Australia CEO Skye Kokoschke-Moore speaking with Powered Media's reporter Emma Myers.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
New South Wales has enacted the Serious Domestic Abuse Prevention Order scheme, aimed at tackling domestic violence, giving police the power to track offenders' phones. Under the scheme, those with a serious history of abuse are required to disclose it on dating profiles. The scheme is the first of its kind in Australia and could influence how other states approach offender accountability and survivor safety. With domestic violence remaining a national crisis, the reforms are sparking discussion about how technology and law can work together to address the issue. The Wire's Ella Panizzolo spoke with the CEO of Full Stop, Karen Biavan, to find out more about self-reporting on dating profiles.
What we know about, you know, how online dating profiles have been used and the way that, you know, the online environment is being used by people who have used harm, sexual violence and domestic violence, it tells us that there are some people there that are of concern.
Do you see any risks of this shifting responsibility back onto victims to protect themselves rather than addressing perpetrators' behaviour?
Overall, you know, many of our responses to people who use violence seem to put victim survivors of violence or people who are at risk in the driver's seat for taking responsibility. That is a strategy we've seen used over and over. It's not appropriate and it doesn't work. So I think that if we don't want to over-rely on schemes that require people to self-report, and for victim survivors or for just any woman out there in the world using a dating app to be somehow responsible for screening people for a history of violence. So on that level, I think, you know, it's not appropriate to rely on those kinds of initiatives. However, in the context of the New South Wales scheme, actually kind of makes sure that police are aware that those people who've been identified in under the serious abuse orders scheme are actually self-reporting to police that they have established a new dating profile. We also know that, you know, people who use violence often have a really strong history of being able to project all sorts of different types of personas. They tell very convincing stories about why they may have been accused of violence by a former partner. They use all kinds of strategies like love bombing and overwhelming people in order to silence those concerns that people might have. You know, pick the person who's used violence against a former partner. But as a form of intelligence for police under the New South Wales scheme, it definitely has merit.
And are there any other tools and supports that also effectively keep women safe online?
Online abuse is disturbingly common and increasing, and the use of, you know, online platforms continues to be of concern. So lawmakers need to be keeping an eye on where are the cracks that offenders are, you know, exploiting, and where does, you know, how do we continue to make our legislation relevant? And then we need to make sure that governments are really getting behind their domestic violence and sexual violence response services to make sure that they can be there for victim survivors to get the help they need. So there is work to do, and I think every state and territory, you know, is both interested, but some of, you know, some are proceeding faster than others. And, you know, really think it's important that each jurisdiction is, you know, really openly about what they're doing and learning from that and making sure that everyone's aware of where it's working and any challenges.
How important is it that policymakers consult survivor advocacy organisations like yours before these laws spread nationally?
It's so important that the voices of survivors, victim survivors of all kinds, are heard and taken seriously in the policy process. There are so many incredibly articulate people who've got expertise that sadly comes through lived experience of violence, but also they've got expertise about that they've learned through managing systems, dealing with perpetrators, dealing with police, dealing with court systems. They bring a perspective that is absolutely vital to good policy.
CEO of Full Stop, Karen Biavan, speaking with The Wire's Ella Panizzolo. I'm Emma Watsky, and you're listening to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. A huge hello to our friends at 8CCC in Alice Springs, and three-way radio in Warrnambool, and of course to our listeners at Tune FM in Armidale. The recent National Climate Risk Assessment warns of Australia's increasing climate challenge and shows extreme weather risks are widespread and likely to intensify without urgent action. The report also maps areas of high threat, providing guidance for planning, insurance, and adaptation. But Australians continue to witness skyrocketing costs from extreme weather, with recent analysis estimating losses of $4.5 billion a year, according to Insurance Council of Australia reporting. And vulnerable communities are bearing the brunt, with homes in high-risk areas, which are often uninsured or underinsured. The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with Associate Professor at Griffith University, Johanna Nalayu, to hear more.
The recent National Climate Risk Assessment identifies hotspots and priority areas for action. How can this evidence guide both government planning and community preparedness?
I think the climate risk, National Climate Risk Assessment really looked at a range of climate change impacts across a range of scenarios as well. So what might happen by, for instance, by 2050. So one of the really key issues, for instance, is increases in extreme heat and heat-related deaths as well. And I think that it gives really good understanding of the range of risks that we are facing in Australia. But we also have the National Adaptation Plan that then looks at, well, what can we actually do? And so I think there will be a lot of discussion between the different levels of government and other stakeholders as well, what types of actions we should now be investing in now that we, you know, have a really good understanding of the different types of risks.
Are certain populations more vulnerable in extreme weather events?
Absolutely. And I think that both the National Climate Risk Assessment and the National Adaptation Plan really make that point. So if we think about, for instance, renters or low-income groups, especially the elderly and children, so their sensitivity to a lot of the climate impacts is very different as well. And the adaptation options that they would need are not necessarily always available either. So if you think about, for instance, people renting, often they don't really have a lot of say, for instance, if they wanted to, for instance, live in a place where there's more insulation against extreme heat or better drainage, for instance, against extreme rainfall.
What is the risk for Australians remaining uninsured in rural or farming areas?
The uninsurability is a major issue. I mean, obviously, that's not just in the rural areas, but we know that from the Insurance Council of Australia's report that just came out a few days ago, this is one of the key issues that they raised, that there are these inequalities already where some regions are actually really high risk and new areas are being estimated as high risk due to climate impacts. And then the insurance industry is obviously looking at, well, you know, if we know already about these areas, then we won't be necessarily giving insurance, or they're being priced out of the sector. So, for instance, we know that after the Lismore floods in 2022, some areas had, you know, their flood insurance just skyrocketed. So it was like $30,000 a year, and that's just not affordable.
Looking forward, what other strategies like insurance reform could help Australians adapt to the increasing risk of climate change?
I mean, there's a range of things that can be done at different levels. So some people say, well, we really need to look at land use planning. We need to look at the National Building Code. We need to really start thinking about, well, what does a resilient home mean in Australia in a changing climate? And there's a lot of work that's being done, for instance, by the Resilient Building Council, and they're really looking into this with the federal government as well and the different insurance companies, how we are building houses. And that also includes, obviously, retrofitting, but there is often an upfront cost, for instance, if you want to build a more sustainable home so that can increase the cost. But then obviously, I mean, that will pay off later on. But that kind of discussion is really needed. Well, how do we build homes retrofit the homes that we already have? And what do we do with these really high risk areas?
Associate Professor at Griffith University, Johanna Naliu, speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Since the creation of social media algorithms, there has been a decline in body positivity. But could this worsen if the women we're seeing aren't real? This could be a glimpse into our future after US Vogue's August magazine included an AI-generated model. She's tall, blonde, and skinny, which raises several concerns around ideals, with some fearing this could threaten diversity efforts and increase women's body image issues. The Wire's contributor from The Source News, Amelia Wise, has the story.
If you haven't heard, Seraphine Valora is a hot new name blowing up on social media with over 200,000 followers. But this isn't the latest influencer. It is a brand creating lifelike models with artificial intelligence. Co-founded by Valentina Gonzalez and Andrea Petrescu, Seraphine Valora is no common ChatGPT, but a huge team working together in hopes to innovate the industry. After their guest campaign featured in Vogue, many users critiqued the lack of diversity in their portfolio, especially due to the unlimited options they would have with AI, which led many to wonder, what message is this sending to women?
AI-generated models do not have any of the normal flaws or imperfections that an everyday person might have.
That's Professor Rojin McNanny, a digital health researcher at the University of Melbourne. Her latest work revolves around social media and its correlation to eating disorders.
It's just taking us 20 steps back in relation to where we've come in the fashion industry.
And evidently so. A 2024 Dove report shows almost half of Australian women have felt pressured to alter their appearance because of online content, even when they knew the images were fake or AI generated.
Obviously, we've got Photoshop and flaws are removed, but the concept that the flaws aren't even there in the first place is a little bit mind-boggling.
Professor McNanny says these could lead to more concerning issues.
So we know that there's massive impacts that social media can have on body image and the formation of disordered eating practices.
But Seraphine Valora justifies these stereotypical model images, claiming they tried posting diverse models on social media, but their engagement dropped, in some cases by 10 times. However, sacrificing diversity for likes on social media may be impacting the mental health of audiences more than we think.
Improving diversity on the type of content that people view has really positive protective factors in terms of their body image.
So, could it be the case that companies need to push more diversity, or do we need to be an active audience in choosing whose content we engage with? Perhaps it's a case of how these models were created. CEO of Icon Management, Chelsea Bonner, has been in the modeling industry for over 20 years and says AI models are threatening the industry.
Every fake avatar that you see is actually a composite of 100 other real women that have been stolen and used to create one avatar.
Seraphine Valora says they do hire models for their projects, but for Australia in particular, there is limited regulations and legislation for AI models.
They don't have to identify anything.
Which also raises the question, if models start losing their jobs, will this impact other industries?
You know, just in this last year, the amount of marketing companies, advertising agencies, producers that I know personally who have just had to close their doors and walk away, it will displace industry worth about $123 billion to the Australian economy. And if that industry collapses, all of the taxes, superannuation, Medicare levies and everything else that we provide to the Australian economy disappears.
So if AI models have displaced professions and are harming our body image, why is it happening? Western Sydney University's professor Gemma Sharp leads research for body image and eating disorders.
An AI model is far cheaper to generate and create than paying photography, a model. This is a far cheaper way of advertising.
But it's not all doom and gloom for AI, because researchers such as Professor Sharp are using new technology for good. Let me introduce you to Chatbot Gem, a platform created with people aged 13 and up, including parents and carers.
What we do is give information just like this about how social media can be unrealistic and how you should follow people who make you feel good about yourself and unfollow people who make you feel negatively about yourself.
And for individuals already struggling with body image, researchers are working on chatbots for eating disorder treatment.
Chatbot that helps people who are on the wait list for eating disorder services to provide a single session assessment and intervention to kind of give them psychoeducation resources while they wait for their appointments.
Overall, we don't know what holds for the future of AI in Australia, and this could just be the beginning. Make sure to be cautious online and put yourself first. Don't be afraid to reach out if you need help.
The Wire's contributor from The Source News, Amelia Wise, with that story. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from 4EB in Brisbane. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne. And Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.